This is MACO President Jerry Walker, and you're listening to the Conduit Street Podcast, the official podcast of the Maryland Association of Counties. Hello and welcome to the Conduit Street Podcast. Kevin Canale here, MACO's Policy Associate, joined as always by my co-host, MACO's Executive Director, Michael Sanderson.
Hey, Kevin.
Today on the podcast, we are going to talk about a significant development in road funding for Maryland's counties. We're also going to talk about the Budget Reconciliation and Financing Act, the BRFA, which has been a hot topic this week. Then we'll get into the long-anticipated not commission bill. This is, it has to do with school construction funding. And then we'll talk about school security, which has also been a hot topic over the past week. Michael, let's jump right into it. So in the space of a day last week, the whole conversation around local roads funding changed.
Yeah, so this is our highway user revenues conversation. And if you've been listening to the podcast for the last couple of months, you may already be tired of us talking about local road funding and thinking, you know, these guys go on and on about local roads week after week. The fact is, that's just the tip of the iceberg. This is like a 9 or 10 year issue for local governments. In the summer of 2009, when, you know, the economy was falling apart and the state budget was falling apart with it, that's when we lost most of our share of state transportation revenues. And ever since then, this has been the sort of the fiscal gorilla in the room between the state and local governments. Whose responsibility is it to pay for all these roads?
Right. And so it's been our top initiative for, as you said, many years. And it seems now that there is some sort of deal in the works. House Bill 807 has been amended in the Environment and Transportation Committee. Apparently, there is a deal with that committee's chairman, the chairman of Appropriations, the Speaker of the House, and the President of the Senate.
Yeah, even the Senate leadership has apparently signed on to this. So this is more than just a small development. This may have just tipped from being an issue where we had our head in our hands saying, what do we do next, to suddenly, like, this might be done.
So let's talk about the deal that's on the table. So apparently this is a five-year funding plan that would start in 2020. This right. year would be unaffected, right? We'd still have to advocate for our yeah. transportation grant.
So the state budget debate right now is for fiscal 2019, mm-hmm. and the governor has proposed an extra layer of grant funding. A lot of that comes back to counties. That's something we value. We'll try and defend keeping that in this year's budget. The legislation they're talking about would affect the following year. So in the 2019 session for the 2020 fiscal year budget would be the first year of this effect. And their proposal is county funding is going to basically double.
Right. So about $58 million would be the total on the table right now. So that's about $30 million extra for 5 years. So $30 million a year for 5 years.
Yeah.
And let's get into the specifics here. So this not only affects counties, it also affects municipalities and Baltimore City, of course. But you have been, you know, in the room and you've heard about these negotiations and whatnot. What is your perspective here on this deal that's on the table and what it means for counties?
Well, I think, you know, as we've talked about this issue in previous podcasts, we sensed that this issue had broadened. Mm-hmm. We there were multiple bills put in. Over the last few years, we've seen different champions say, I have this idea or I have that idea. I mean, this year, I lost count. It must be 7, 8, 9 different bills put in with different timetables or how high is the goal or how fast do we do it and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, different versions of the same thing, but it's been both parties. It's been both, you know, metropolitan and rural legislators saying it's time to make a fix here. I think the impression that this is not a localized issue, this is something that affects every community, eventually sort of wore down the argument that it's a tough lift and it's a difficult things to fix. So you end up with the legislature, you know, the legislators in the House, leadership particularly, saying it's time to try and pull something together, and it may not be the full solution that some folks are asking for. And I mean, this doesn't fully restore county funds.
Not even close, right?
But doubling the level of commitment, you know, going from about 30 a year to about 60 a year for the counties, I mean, that moves the needle.
Yeah, it's certainly significant. And I guess, you know, there has been a different feel this year in terms of highway user revenue, you know, restoring at least some of those revenues. And as you said, you know, there's been multiple bills in, a lot more conversation than I've seen in the past about this issue. So, you know, I felt like maybe this was the year they may do something, but this is the deal that's on the table. So I guess, is this basically a done deal? Is this the best deal that is probably going to be on the table?
I mean, I think what we're likely to see is this bill will probably be on the floor of the House of Delegates Monday or Tuesday of this coming week. So we're in early March. There's time for things to flow around, but it's just, you know, we're just a little bit ahead of the budget itself moving. Mm-hmm. So it's decision time on fiscal issues, and we're going to talk about the budget reconciliation bill hearing and so forth. It's time to, you know, get off the stick and make some decisions on things. I think there will be some questions about, you know, how did you arrive at this magic spot, but the idea that you know, the E&T committee at Environment and Transportation that has primary jurisdiction over transportation funding reached out and worked with the Appropriations Committee. That's who does the budget writ large, and also coordinated with the Senate leadership to sort of say, if we pull this together, is this something that the Senate's going to be able to work on, rather than have it be a whole new debate over there?
Right.
That all that came together before they moved anything suggests that this may just happen. This may be this is the deal you're going to get.
Right. So all the stakeholders in the General Assembly came together here beforehand and made sure that everyone was on board before this deal was presented. And, you know, I think that maybe this will be the best deal, but, you know, you mentioned that there is still a lot of time to work some of this stuff out, and we'll see. But right now, what we're seeing and what we're hearing is that $30 million extra for 5 years. And that's certainly significant.
Yeah. So it's welcome the amount of attention and the amount of effort that's gone into addressing this issue. We have a number of people who have been champions on it. And this is, again, both parties, mm-hmm. urban and rural, a lot of legislators who knew this was the right thing to do and put pressure all through the session. We've had folks here at the Mako offices talking strategy, getting grabbed in the hallways about who else can I talk to? I want to talk to my committee chair. I want to talk to somebody on the E&T committee. They seem to be working on this. That's encouraging to have people that are that committed.
Absolutely. It's a majorly important issue for local governments. And, you know, talking about this issue, this is a sign of things starting to come together in the fiscal plan. And Michael, you just came from the BRFA hearing, and what was your impression of how that went? I watched that testimony. You were there with MAKO's president, Jerry Walker, and I thought you all did a great job. But what was the impression that you got from that hearing for local governments?
Yeah, so this is the Budget Reconciliation and Financing Act. It's the bill that rides along with the budget itself. The budget bill is just the spending plan. And anything you need to change in law or authorize a fund swap or transfer of monies into the general fund or other things like that, it sort of brings the whole fiscal picture together in one big omnibus bill that does, you know, 20, 30, 40 different things. So in this setting, I've been in the past, over doing this for a lot of years, I've been in hearings on budget reconciliation bills that were really heated, really controversial, went on for hours and hours into the night, and, you know, a lot of debates and that sort of thing. This year, both the Senate hearing on Wednesday, and we're recording on Friday afternoon earlier today in the House, this was quick, to the point. A number of people had their suggestions and their changes and so forth, but it was a very succinct presentation by the budget secretary, mm-hmm. by the legislative staff, and really by most of the interest groups.
Yeah, it's really amazing. I mean, as you know, in the Senate and the House, it was very short. There weren't a lot of questions. And in years past, we have seen a ton of questions, you mm-hmm. know, basically grilling some of the witnesses that are up there testifying. But, you know, this was very short and sweet. And we raised two issues today, right?
Right. So, I mean, one, and faithful listeners, hats off to you. We'll remember we've been talking about this, the cost shift for the state assessment mm-hmm. department, all their employees and all their functions and equipment and so forth. This bill has a proposal to shift up to, it becomes a 90% cost share for county governments. Just the counties, not municipalities. That's a little weird, but
and right now it's 50%.
Yeah, so it would make this the overwhelming share of the fiscal responsibilities on county governments. Meanwhile, we don't hire the staff, we don't make the decisions on what equipment to use or to buy, we don't make any of the tactical managerial decisions. We just pick up the check. Mm-hmm. Instead of it being 50-50 to go to 90-10, effectively says that the state who manages and oversees all this really has virtually no skin in the game.
Right.
And that just as a matter of properly managing government, we have big troubles with that. Aside, there's this philosophical issue of, if eventually it becomes a responsibility of the county governments to make all these decisions, and I think that's the direction this would go, mm-hmm. then you end up, we use this phrase, the fox in the hen house.
Right, right. So, really, right now, Maryland is looked upon as getting this right, right? Nationally, right. We're known for getting right. this issue right.
Right. I mean, people from around the country, even in Guam, they're all looking at Maryland saying, we got this one right.
So, Guam is definitely looking at Maryland and saying we got it right. So, all right, so there was another issue raised today, Michael, and you raised it. There were a few questions about it. Let's get into how that went today and talk about that second issue.
Yeah, there's a clause in the budget reconciliation bill, and it also appears in a standalone mandate relief bill that the administration has introduced. I mean, the argument here is, should you give a catch-all clause to say various things in law that have a formula or some other structure that oblige state spending, should you give a catch-all waiver when times get tough and the economy looks weak?
So there's sort of like a circuit breaker here where, if you don't have certain growth, you don't have to fund that mandated spending.
Right. So counties are a big stakeholder in this because there's quite a number of functions at the county level where the state makes a contribution, and by and large, those are guided by these various formulas. I mean, the example we ended up talking about the most at the hearing today was local health departments, and I think it's a fair one because they're targeted by this reconciliation bill. So, I mean, what I think MACO has said and county governments have said about this idea, this is not a new idea,
right,
to do mandate relief of one form or another. This is sort of an executive branch, legislative branch, tug of war. Mm-hmm. Right now, that has a partisan element, but that has not always been the case. We've had executives of the Democratic Party who feel the same way.
Right.
Said, boy, I'd like to not have to do as many things as this legislature would have me do. Mm-hmm. We've historically come down on the side of things in statute mean you have to have a public debate to decide this year we can't afford to do it.
So like today, that the BRFA hearing, that gives you the forum and other advocates who would like to get the BRFA amended or advocate for their positions on the BRFA, that gives them the venue to do that.
Right.
If we adopt this proposal that's on the table that the executive branch would like to see come to fruition, that forum would be gone.
Right. And that's a function of Maryland has this peculiar budget process where every dollar in the budget has to come and be proposed by the governor. It's an executive budget process. No other state has anything that really looks and feels like this. But what it means is, and like back to the local health departments as an example, this year they have a formula in state law that says each year they're supposed to get a little bump in their funding so they can keep up with population and cost of living. Mm-hmm. And this year, governor has proposed in the BRFA bill, I know that's the mandate, but I want to skip it for this year on account of affordability. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, but for him to do that, he puts it in a bill and says it's a contingent cut in the budget, pass my bill and I'll cut the money. Mm-hmm. The legislature now gets to have a debate. Do we need to fund it or is it no longer affordable this year? And do we pass the BRFA language that the governor has proposed?
Right.
And then we as counties or as health officers can show up at that hearing and try and make the case. You got to keep the money in or no big deal, we'll let it go.
Yeah, you got to have that public hearing so that, as you mentioned, counties can show up and other advocates can show up and that the legislature can hear from the folks that would be most affected by the proposed cuts in the BRFA.
Right. And so, I mean, back in the early 1990s, and forgive me for trying to, you know, make some dinosaur arguments when people were just walking around with stone tablets and so forth.
I don't know how
but,
you did it.
But
then,
but in the early 90s, the local health department funding was not mandated in state law. And when things got tough, the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene at the time was told by the governor at that time, Governor Schaefer, we need to make budget cuts. And they said, well, we'll just cut local health departments by half. And it was done.
Right.
Because the governor just proposes a budget with fewer dollars in it and it's over. There's no way for the legislature to debate whether that's a good cut. And there's no public forum for stakeholders to show up and say, I wish you wouldn't do that.
So our two arguments here are stop the shift. We don't think it's right to shift SDAT 90% of the cost onto counties and keep the public forum available for this process so that advocates can come and they can have their seat at the table and express why whatever they want to be cut or not cut is you know the reasons that they want to do that.
Right. So this is the big process. As the legislature starts to frame its whole fiscal package, the budget reconciliation bill is the administration all-purpose proposal. But this also effectively becomes sort of the toboggan that you can load up with any other provision. If something came up in a budget hearing, and you know we can save a little money in this provision on state employee health insurance, you just toss it in the BRFA. You don't need to introduce a brand new bill and have 17 extra bills that ride along. You just put these provisions into the budget reconciliation bill, you pass it all at once, and that'll be coming together in the couple weeks ahead.
Yeah, things should start to move quickly now with the budget process. We'll certainly keep you updated on what's going on there, but I think in terms of MAKO and in terms of our roads funding and the BRFA bill, significant updates this week.
Yep.
We're going to go ahead and take a break. When we come back, we'll get into school construction and school safety, all that and more after the break. Welcome back to the Conduit Street Podcast. Kevin Canale here with Michael Sanderson. And now we'll jump into school construction legislation that we have been waiting to see for quite some time. This is all about the Knott Commission. They were charged with looking at school construction funding, how to best build schools, efficient cost. And it's worth mentioning that this is one of MAKO's legislative initiatives. We are advocating for strong and smart school construction funding. So keep the funding strong and spend efficiently. And we saw this bill. It's a 31-page bill. There are a long list of provisions in the bill, but I think when you dive in, there are a fair number of issues that this commission talked about that they decided they're going to take a little more time and study before they make final recommendations. And I think that's probably a good idea. Some of these issues need to be worked out. They need a little bit more time and a little bit more finessing before they can make a final decision.
And there's a whole process that led up to the introduction of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something we've been following for 2 years now, that for around 2 years' time, the commission itself has been having its meetings and doing its own analysis of where we are in school construction, what processes are working, you know, where can we save money, where can we save time, how can we do some things you know, more efficiently and so forth. They've been all over the map on things to look at.
Mm-hmm.
They came back and said they needed an extra year for more time to look at issues. So this wasn't a 2017 session issue. It became a 2018 session issue. Mm-hmm. The parallels with the Kirwan Commission looking on you know day-to-day funding is kind of strong. But the interesting thing is the commission had its final meeting back in December and nominally issued sort of an interim report, and then we drummed our fingers and waited for a final report and still didn't quite know how many of those things were going to end up in legislation. Because the world of school construction is kind of this weird mix of process and regulations and structure and then legislation as well. So how much of it do you need to put in a bill to make changes?
Well, evidently a lot. 31-page bill. And I think one of the issues that they decided needed a little more time was one of the issues that was being talked about a lot here in Annapolis, and that's the Knott Commission, and I think most people would agree that we should rank all of our schools and we should go in and assess the condition and see who needs the most help. But one of the big questions was, how will you use those rankings to influence funding? And that was a contentious debate, I think, here in Annapolis and around the state. And the commission decided that they needed a work group to decide how they'll deal with those rankings as it deals with funding. So if they want to tie funding to who needs the most help, or if there's a formula that they would rather use, I think that's probably one of these ideas that does need some more time. And it's smart for them to go ahead and take that time rather than rushing and making a decision that could backfire on them.
Yeah, I think it's a classic case of the devil's in the details, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, at the one sentence or two sentence level, you would say, we should go out and look at every school and do an evaluation of where are their systems, how's their maintenance look, is the building in good shape, or is there a big need coming up, that sort of thing. And, I mean, who's going to say, oh, that sounds like a bad idea. We don't want to know the condition of our school buildings. All right, so fine, we all agree. Let's harvest the information so we have good systemic maintenance information on the facilities. Then it turns into, well, now that we have all this, we could probably sort the schools. We could turn it into these are the ones that are in the most desperate need, or these are the ones that have been tended to the most recently, and so forth. And then, wow, this gets a little bit tricky when you start saying, wow, here's a jurisdiction that's been making a big commitment to keep their schools in good shape, and they get a high grade for maintenance, and they've been doing what most of us would probably say, the right thing by continuing to commit to ongoing maintenance. And now it turns out, well, you're not in the dire need, so you're going to have to wait for funding. The place next door that's been doing a lousy job, their stuff's falling apart. We got to rescue them.
Right, and that's part of this debate that's been ongoing. And I think that, again, this work group to work those details out, it's probably a really good idea. They also delayed major decisions on funding, although they did say that we need to keep this commitment strong. And they want, you know, $400 million. They set that as a goal, which is more than the state is funding school construction right now. And then once they decide what the final number should be, they'll come back and say, here's what we think. But until they make that final decision, they're saying at least $400 million. That should be the target.
Right. And, I mean, the lay of the land here is that every year, the school systems come to the state with their list of school projects that they think, you know, the population requires this. We are over capacity in these current schools. We need either this expansion, we need a new school, we need an old one to be replaced and modernized and so forth. The number of school projects that are defensible, that are basically ready to go, that are, you know, supported by the demographics and the number of students and so forth, is way more than what the state is able to fund in any given year. So we're not like manufacturing, let's spend money and then let's see if there's something out there to spend it on. Every year, good projects go unfunded.
Absolutely. So some of the other issues that they put into this bill, technological advances for more efficient and innovative schools, streamlined compliance review and project deliveries, best use of buildings in districts with declining enrollment, regional school construction projects, which, you know, would include P3, public-private partnership zones, and regional career and tech schools. Michael, one of the other things that was in this bill that I think is a major issue are eligible costs.
Yeah, this is sort of a thorn in the side of local governments, I think, going way back. And the commission spent some time on this. Didn't exactly nail down and say we've solved this, but the question is, the state makes a contribution to the cost of a school project and then has a definition of these are the things we're willing to pay for. Okay, that's fine, but everybody knows that if you're going to build a school building, you have costs up front just to lay it out. You need to spend money on architects and engineers and site design and planning and so forth. I mean, that's part of a project.
Sure, those are costs.
Right, and if you've got a $50 or $60 million school project, that might be $5, $6, $10 million of a project like that. The state for policy reasons that are decades old, and they may or may not be good reasons, but the state says those are not costs that we participate in. That's entirely on you, locals. You do all the upfront work. You do all the site design and the architect and engineering, and then we'll start helping with the bricks and the mortar.
Right. So let us know when you're finished with all that stuff in the beginning, and then come to us and we'll start giving you the money.
Here's your 50%.
Right.
So, like, there's a number of jurisdictions where the state-county split is 50%, and you're thinking, wow, a $60 million school project, that's going to be $30 million from the state and $30 million from the county.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah, a 50% county will tell you the usual split is more like 70-30,
yeah.
And that the state contribution will be a whole lot less. So that's $60 million. You know, the state's in for 19.
Right, right. So it's good that I guess they're looking at this issue. And as you said, it's a decades old. You know, these are decades old policy issues that go way, way back. So I guess on one hand, it's really good that they're looking at this stuff now.
Yeah, I mean, the change isn't in this bill, and I think that would have been controversial and maybe made it a little difficult to swallow,
mm-hmm.
but I think it's something we continue to be interested in, and there's a pretty good fairness argument that all, you know, a larger share of the costs ought to be on the table as a split.
Absolutely. So we do have a really great summary that was written by our colleague Robin Eilenberg. It's on our website, on our blog. It's conduitstreet.mdcounties.org. You can just search Knott Commission, and that'll come up. But fantastic summary of a 31-page bill. If you don't want to read the whole bill.
Which you don't.
You don't. She breaks it down, and she does a fantastic job. So check that out.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that you mentioned along the way that the counties have been interested in here also is this idea of compliance reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think, a potential for a good split between the larger and the smaller counties that might make sense for everybody. You have the state. The state has staff that they can look over the plans and designs and sort of sign off that everything fits the education specifications and all the standards that we're looking for in our school buildings and that sort of thing. So right now, the state staff has to review, or effectively is reviewing, every single project,
mm-hmm.
even ones that there's already been a substantial review at the county level. So, you know, some of our largest jurisdictions, the Montgomery counties or Baltimore counties or Prince George's counties of the world, I mean, they're big jurisdictions. They're in the school building business. They know how to do this already. They've already made the exact same checks with quality people who know what they're doing. And then you sit around for 8 months and wait for the staff people to basically just check your work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to the extent that time is money, and in an environment of escalating costs, that's true. The idea of, let's find jurisdictions that have this level of staff already, let their sign off suffice, and skip that extra intermediate step. And then, meanwhile, if you're Caroline County, or if you're, you know, Somerset County, and you've got a school, the occasional school project, but you don't have the staff locally to do that evaluation, the state will step in and do it for you, and they'll lend their expertise. I think you get the best of both worlds.
I think that's such an important point, because it's not a one-size-fits-all solution in this area, right? You have some counties that can do this, and then some who are really reliant on the state to provide that service. So it's going to be important that they strike the right balance and don't try to implement a one-size-fits-all solution there. But I think it's heading in the right direction in that regard.
I think so.
All right, now let's get into another really hot topic. For unfortunate reasons, there was another school shooting in Florida, and just awful, the scenes coming out of Florida. But, you know, we've seen this across the country, and it's just terrible. But it has garnered significant conversation here in Annapolis, and Governor Hogan announced some school safety initiatives this week. He wants to provide $125 million for school safety enhancements, plus $50 million in annual grants, and he has emergency legislation to create statewide standards and support for some issues such as, again, enhancing safety in schools, increased coordination among schools and state agencies and law enforcement, and keeping firearms out of the hands of the mentally ill and individuals with violent criminal records.
All right, so there's multiple pieces to this, and to the extent that part of this debate is about our schools and the facilities, the mm-hmm. buildings and the systems we have around them, and making sure we're doing all we can to make those safe places, now you've got county governments and our school boards as stakeholders. So you know, this is something that not only is it interesting and important, but it affects county budgets and our priorities and so forth too. The notion of let's find some emergency funding. Actually, like literally just today, the governor introduced a supplemental budget. We've talked about the budget process, but this is the way the governor can add components to the budget he's already introduced. He said $5 million for this coming year's budget as add-on funding, half of that going for grants to go back to presumably the school boards, that you're going to need to do some things to do some measurement and find out where we are, what do our systems look like, make that a funded mandate. I mean, hey, we beat the drum.
That, yeah.
We beat the drum on unfunded mandates, so that's put your money where your mouth is. Mm-hmm. The other half of the money going for getting the team in place that's going to sort of be the clearinghouse and oversight over a school safety program. So he's committed to this, and that's already put this in play in the budget discussion.
So the $5 million is certainly he's committed to that, and that's should be a done deal. The interesting part of this is that the other money that we talked about first, the 125 and then the 50, this proposal says that money will come out of this so-called lockbox. And we've talked about the lockbox proposals before. And, you know, just to give a quick refresher, the revenues that the state gains from casinos and slot machines, all the gambling revenues, there are proposals on the table to put that in a separate fund, a lockbox. And the proposals that we've heard said that money's going to go on top of the current funding that the state has. So that money's already been spoken for. But now we see this proposal that also takes the money out of the lockbox. So it's very interesting. It's a very interesting policy discussion about how can you take this money out of the lockbox that's already been spoken for.
Right. And I mean, fiscal issues get this way sometimes that and this is why the Education Trust Fund has been confusing to a lot of citizens and has been puzzling to politicians. Is what did it mean when we took casino revenues and we put them into an education trust fund?
Right.
Well, that money's being used for education. Does that mean it's all above and beyond what our old formula said? No, this was the revenue that's basically making it possible for the state to live up to the Thornton funding promises. Okay, I mean, reasonable people probably can and will disagree on how that has worked and whether that's a good fit. But now you've got a situation where, I mean, this is a new baby bird in the same nest, and there's only so many worms to go around. I mean, however you want to slice it, there's something like $400 or $500 million of net revenue from casino operations. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to say that's our new education commitment above and beyond in years going forward. And as we talked, I think it was last week, that the governor has one vision of how to do it. The legislature has another vision. That'll work itself out over the course of the session. But however you structure that, if the idea is this money is separate for the above and beyond, if you introduce a new fairly costly thing to do with the above and beyond money, what does that come at the expense of? What are those other baby birds? It's pre-K funding, it's career and technical education, it's more teacher training, all these things that the Kirwan Commission has been looking at, and that education advocates are basically, they got their knives and forks in their hand, they're saying, you know, we're ready for the next wave.
But at the same time, it's obvious that we need to prioritize school safety. So I think it's a very interesting idea, and I think it's hard for the education advocates to come out and say, no, don't do this. You know, this money's already been spoken for. But, you know, it's an interesting discussion. And I think that obviously this is a great idea. We've seen some counties already committing money to enhancing schools. And, you know, in the wake of all these terrible, terrible mass shootings, it's really good to see the governor committing to enhancing public safety at our schools. The legislature has a number of proposals in the works in forms of legislation that would enhance safety as well, and local government. So everyone coming together here to do the right thing is an awfully good thing to see here in Annapolis.
Right. So on policy grounds and fiscal grounds, this is one of those things that's going to take some time in the weeks ahead. Governor's got a proposal, and that's a call to action. Legislature's got to figure out where this fits into a puzzle that's already tough. I mean, remember, this idea of putting money into the lockbox isn't a matter of there's new money falling out of the sky and, oh, heavens, what are we going to do with all this wonderful new money? The fact of the matter is, if you say that casino revenues are not available to fund our current education commitment, you now have a hole in the boat in the base budget.
That's so, a problem.
Yeah. So you gotta figure that out along the way too.
So a lot to figure out here, but bottom line, everyone wants to make the commitment to make sure that our students are safe, to do the right thing in that regard, and that's certainly a good thing.
So we're into the month of March. We've been talking about fiscal issues coming together. We're a couple of weeks away from the crossover deadline where, you know, the big flurry of activity for bills the legislature wants to pass are supposed to be making progress out of committee, onto the floor, out of their house of origin. This felt to me like the first sort of breakneck speed week. And this business with the highway user revenue deal popped out of the sky, and in the space of a day, our 9-year fight went from top of our priority list to maybe it's done for the whole year. That's what March tends to be like.
Yeah, and I will agree with you. It was certainly fast and furious this week, and we'll see the same moving forward. We have lots of bills to testify on. We're still analyzing a lot of bills, and we're out there advocating. We're fighting for the counties. That'll do it for this week's episode of the Conduit Street Podcast. As always, if you enjoy the podcast, please give us a like on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. However you listen to the podcast, it certainly helps us get our message out. And until next week, Michael and Kevin signing off. We will talk to you soon.